think probably maybe it will start in Europe or Japan. It's kind of a coin toss-up, but it looks to be more like around 27. And you can see it starting already. If you look at France, all right, the government collapsed, et cetera. French corporate rates went below that of government. And the government rates of France went above that of Greece. That's showing you what I've been talking about. It's a shift from public to private. We have one of the biggest pension funds in North America. They basically started dumping government debt and moving to corporate. S&P walked in and to do an audit and said, "Oh, you're taking on more risk." And they said, "Look, sorry, we use Armstrong and we verified what he said."
Marty Armstrong, Armstrong Economics. Good morning to you. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Interesting times we do live in.
Indeed, and that's really what I want to work out here. Let's start now. Where exactly are we in that interesting times as far as geopolitically? I know that it seems like Europe is falling apart. A lot of changes in the U.S., but there seems like this uprising everywhere, especially in Europe. But yeah, start commenting, working that out for me. Where are we exactly at?
Well, our computer basically shows we're heading into what we've been warning about is it projects 2032 that all forms of our present types of government are going to collapse and be redesigned. You go through these things on average, usually I would say once every 300 years or so. But I mean, the last time we had a big revolution, it was against monarchy. Okay. And then we create these republics. Republics are actually the most corrupt form of government. Unfortunately, our founding fathers read Cicero, who was the fake news in the ancient world, really. But just look at it this way. When Caesar crossed the Rubicon, all right, all the cities cheered. There was a debt crisis exactly as we have. He did not have to fight his way to Rome. The Senate is the one that fled to Rome, to Asia. Why? Because the people didn't support them. If somebody, went in there and started to, arrest, politicians in Congress for corruption, would we go there to defend them? It was pretty bad back then at that time. They had a debt crisis, and most of the people, they thought it was so bad, they thought Caesar was just going to wipe out all the debts. He didn't do that. What he did was actually a very brilliant move to save the economy, per se. What he did was whatever you paid in interest was applied to principal. And he basically netted out that way. And he set up a committee that revalued, basically all the property that whatever you had borrowed against. It was back then, let's say you took a mortgage out for your house of $200,000 and real estate collapses and it's only worth $20,000. They would take the house, but say, "Oh, you still owe us 200 grand." So it was a little bit different back then. And if you couldn't pay that, they took your kids and they sold them into slavery, So that was a little bit more of a debt crisis with a little more teeth, I guess, And so that's why the people cheered Caesar. That's really why he crossed the Rubicon. to give you an example how corrupt the Republic was, we have, you know, he redesigned the calendar, the Julian calendar, all right, created leap days, etc. Why? Because inserting leap days used to be the discretion of the high priest. So the politicians didn't want to go to an election. They just bribed him and said, give us a couple of extra months. You know, so when Caesar crossed the Rubicon, I think it was January 10th. You know, it was really summer. It should have been winter. You know, it was that screwed up. So he came in. He took the position of high priest, reformed the whole thing, and eliminated the discretion. This is not a dictator. This is somebody who was really trying to reform everything that was there. It had become so corrupt. Cicero was one of the oligarchs. You know, so it was like the fake news, like you're listening to CNN. Oh, that's really what happened, you know? So, I mean, look, fake news has been around for thousands of years. It's just simply the way it's always been. You know, they've often said that, you know, the victor is the one that writes the history, you know? Unfortunately, our founding fathers read Cicero, believed that Rome had, Republic was a revolution against monarchy. So they really, Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire was published in 1776. So putting this in context, that was the theory or the impetus behind the American Revolution. Get rid of monarchy, we'll create a republic, etc. I mean, they were following Rome, actually. You know, they listened to the main Greek philosophers who were against democracy because they felt that people were too stupid to vote, really. So that's kind of why they went with a republic, but we're still in the same situation where the people vote. The Athenian democracy, I think, would have been much better. Mm-hmm. Yes, women didn't have the right to vote, but neither did your children. What it was the head of the household, one person from each household, was kind of like the congressman, represented everybody that was there. He went down the vote. But you also have to understand, women didn't really need the right to vote under those types of conditions. There was no socialistic agenda. Once they got into Marxism and socialism, now, you know, it's coming after you personally. Then everybody does need a right to vote. You know, oh, you can't do this, you can't do that, you know. You know, I mean, you look at history, I mean, they even put a tax at times on people that had a beard, you know. You know, why are there row houses in like Philadelphia in the colonial times? Because there was a window tax.
Yeah.
So they built them all that way to eliminate as many windows as possible. The term take a step up in life, you know what that actually refers to? They taxed you on the number of steps into your house.
This is literal.
Yes. If you were poor, you were on ground level. If you were rich, you basically had steps to get in. So, like, the real rich had, like, three steps, you know? I mean, so that's where that term comes from. It was actually a tax on the number of steps into your house and the number of windows and things of this nature. I mean, when I was over in Warsaw, you know, in Poland, you see a lot of the old brick buildings. And they had the same tax. So what you see is basically all the windows that are bricked up to, you know, eliminate the tax. I mean,
right.
This has been, you know, unfortunately, what makes the Republic the most corrupt is that these senators or congressmen or whatever, they're all up for sale. And they need a lot of money to keep the job. Most people don't realize that. Why are the heads of Goldman Sachs often taking positions in government? Because, gee, if you take that position, you're being forced to do so. Now you cannot have a conflict of interest, so you must sell your stock. Because the government tells you you must sell it, it's tax-free. All right? So, I mean, look, there's a hidden, you know, twist behind everything. This is the way it goes.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that leads me to a question, really, then, is... If you're seeing a fall, if you would, in governments around the world, and it seems like that is certainly the case, if that's what your computer models are predicting, but also it seems like we're anecdotally seeing it, or I wouldn't even say anecdotally, we're seeing it. It's okay. What then, if it's going to, especially domestically here, if a republic goes away, what then? Are we going to back to a democracy, or I mean, not democracy, but a monarchy, or
no? I think. Well, that is the $64 billion question, but I would like to see it go to a direct democracy, and people say, "Oh, well, the philosopher says it's corruption." What's the difference? We vote for a president that's smiles, whatever, are we confident to do that? A direct democracy, we should have the right to vote. Do we go to war with Russia, yes or no? That's what Athens was, okay? Just take Vietnam. Why were all the protests? Mainly because the government decides we're going to war with Vietnam. You're 18, old enough to be drafted, to go die for your country. You were not old enough to take a drink. You had to be 21, and you had to be 21 to vote. But that's democracy? Come on. You had no right to vote, no right to do anything, and you couldn't even have a drink, but you could die. Here's a gun. Go shoot somebody. Is that, human rights? Do we have a right to it? To do anything like that? I mean, we're not asked on any major issues ever. A republic is a representative form of government. We vote for these people and they're supposed to represent us. And they don't. If you understand government and how it really evolved, all right, the King of England did not have the power to directly tax the people. He had to summon the Parliament, okay? And the Parliament had to consent to a tax increase for some war or something to defend the country, whatever. So we still have that structure. Congress is the one that decides to raise or lower taxes. The president cannot. All right. But because they are career politicians, it's always them against us. We want to raise. Okay. Raise taxes so we get paid. Whereas before, the parliament was not there all the time. All right. They were summoned. Okay. To this meeting. All right. Come in. Shall we raise taxes? Whatever. Most people don't realize that I think the flaw to our system is surely the corruption. The founding fathers initially never envisioned Congress being there full time. You were paid on a per diem basis only. There were no annual salaries. That came about with the Civil War. They then bribed people. You vote for us to create this war and we'll give you a salary. And that's what happened. So the whole cronyism, everything has taken place basically since then. They call it the spoil system, you know. Andrew Jackson comes into play and he fires all the people that worked for the previous guy, and he sticks his own people in there. So this has been going on for a long time. You leave a door open and they're going to walk through it.
Yeah. Well, then I guess that leads me to, we're having a lot of firings right now in the federal government, and a lot of corruption is becoming exposed. Do you think it's going to be enough firings? Do you think there'll be enough reform here? Or do you think this is just window dressing, if you would, to appease the populace, if you would, here in the States?
Now, look, Trump is the real deal. But let me explain something here. I used to be part of the vetting process. It would send me in to explain the world economy to these people who wanted to run for president. But it was really a vetting process. And, you know, I get back, I say, what do you think? Can he handle it? Blah, blah, blah. Then I was asked to go meet with Bush Jr. I said, yeah, okay, fine. I said, oh, but this one's different. I said, what's different? He said, he's really stupid. And I'm not joking. I mean, this is what I was told. I said, what? And I asked him, I said, why would you make somebody stupid president? Everything before was, do you think he's smart enough? And they said, well, he's got the name and we can win. So 1999 is where I draw the line. That's when I think it really started going the other way. They picked Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney was really president. They picked the cabinet. I was even asked at the time if I would take, you know, chief economic advisor in the White House. I said, no, thank you. I'm not giving up my company for a 2-year stint in the White House, you know? So I know how it works. I've been there. When Trump came in the first time, oh, you're not a politician. You know, do we have to give confidence to the rest of the world? And they picked his cabinet. They stuffed it with every neocon they could possibly do, John Bolton, you know, et cetera. And every one of them were just stabbing Trump in the back. This is why Trump, this time, now he understands the game. He didn't the first time. This is why he picked his cabinet before he even got into Washington. You're not going to do it to me this time. All right. So if you understand the context of how Washington works, you can see what that was a shot across the bow.
Okay. So that leads me to a few other questions. And that's such a great point then. So then his people are going to get approved, because there's
I think they're even going to have to, you know, approve RFK, etc. I mean, he's gotten in. I know some of them, you know. I wasn't so thrilled with Mark Rubio. I've had contacts with him, but I think he was maybe the compromise to the neocons. You know, I have spoken with RFK. I mean, what is the deep state? The deep state is basically people that are bureaucrats and their career. All right. So you hire, you vote in for a new congressman. Fine. He goes to Washington. Guess what? The staff from somebody else is now his. Okay. They are there all the time. You're told, oh, you need experience. All right. I even put on my blog, because one politician wrote in when I was talking about this, and he says, I agree. He says, when I first came in, all I hear is staff recommend. He says, it's the tail wagging the dog. Why are we even here if we have to do everything the staff recommends? Yes. This is just the way it goes. You can write a letter to your congressman or whatever and say this, that, the other thing. If the person opening that letter doesn't like what you're saying, that congressman's never going to see it.
Yeah.
All right. This is the real deep state. All right. This is why Trump picked his own people, because he knows now. It's not legitimate. It's not honest. They don't care about the country. They don't care about you. This is about them, period. Look at when they give themselves raises. They voted like midnight on a Christmas Eve or something. to make sure, you know, the press doesn't really pick it up so much or whatever. I mean, this is every little tactic is there. Look, yeah. I'll give you a good example. It's going to be interesting to see if the JFK files really do get fully released, or do they suddenly, you know, burn someone? Oh, I dropped a cigarette on. Sorry about that. There is Operation Northwoods, which is on Wikipedia. You can look at it. The CIA proposed killing Americans to blame it on Cuba for an invasion. And Kennedy said no. And Kennedy was of the opinion to shut down the CIA. This whole USAID thing, Kennedy's the one that created that, segregated it off, all right? But then the CIA only took it over. He wanted to shut down the CIA. You can now also look Richard Nixon. He had the head of the CIA in his office, and he said, which was confirmed on the tapes, I know who killed JFK. So Watergate people that all got caught, all ex-CIA, amazing, you know? Oh, you got me. I think a couple of hoods from the ghetto could have done a better job, you know? I had actually bumped into Richard Nixon on the beach in New Jersey after he left office. And I was surprised he wasn't surrounded by Secret Service. Google it. After he left office, he refused to accept Secret Service protection. Why? He didn't trust them. Yeah. What did he know? You know, it people have to understand this thing is much darker than they would ever imagine. I mean, what's coming out of this USA already is the same nonsense, regime change. It's just been a slush fund for neocons. That's what's going on, you know, and I wish Trump all the best. I mean, yeah, I'm surprised they haven't tried a third time to assassinate him, honestly.
Right.
And blame it on Iran or somebody. Oh, it was, you know, China did it or whatever. I mean, it's the same nonsense all the time.
Yeah.
But let me just look at that Operation Northwoods. They actually proposed killing Americans and blaming it on Cuba to justify an invasion.
You know, I did a couple of weeks ago, right when this was starting to come out that the JFK files were going to be released. I found that, and there is a Wikipedia page for it. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of it. And I was in shock. I would say I was in shock, but not really in shock, if you know what I mean.
Oh, that's you can't, I don't think you can get any lower than that.
Right.
Right. You know, it's so then you have people thinking that, you know, that look, a lot of planes can be flown, you know, remotely.
Right.
You know, the day before the planes from 9/11 hit the Pentagon, Rumsfeld is $2.3 trillion is missing from the Pentagon budget.
Right.
He's testifying before Congress. This is outrageous. We'll start an investigation. The plane magically hits the very room where all the records were. Oh, sorry about that. Can't do that.
Yeah.
So was it steered in? I mean, who the heck knows anymore? But I mean, you can't even, you can't rule anything out.
Right.
I mean, that's the problem. I mean, after what I saw with Project, you know, the Operation Northwoods, I mean, they will stoop to anything. Absolutely anything.
Yeah. Well, then what's your opinion then on, and we talked a little bit about this off camera, but what's your opinion then on, I guess, the economy with all this cutting, and where is the global money going to flow? Where's the money flow going to go? Because it seems like if you put it all, I mean, I guess you could say of like Singapore or maybe Southeast Asia, but as far as there's just a ton of money out there that has to be invested somewhere, right? So,
yeah, no, it comes to the United States because we're the biggest economy and can actually absorb the money.
Exactly.
You know, you can't go to Britain, you can't go to, you know, Tokyo or Singapore or something like that. They're just not big enough to handle it. I'll give you an example. I was in our London office and I got a call from one of our institutional clients in Germany. They were one of the major telecommunication companies. And they said, we're having a board meeting. We need you here first thing in the morning. I said, what's up? You'll find out when you get here. I get there. What happens? They appoint our firm advisor to the pension fund. No proposals, no how much, anything. And then they resign. I said, what the hell is going on here? This is a Harry Carey meeting or something or what? They explained to me, and this is relevant to what I see in Washington. They asked the government if they could lay off 20% of the workforce. Government approved. Then at the last minute, the government comes back and says, oh, it wouldn't be fair for you to pick and choose. You have to make that offer to everybody. What happens? You know you can get a job across the street. You take the 150 grand and you leave. All right? The guy who doesn't think he can get a job anywhere because he's the very guy that they wanted to get rid of is the one they get stuck with. What I was told at that board meeting, we're resigning because we don't want our name associated with this company, because then I won't be able to get a job. This company's going to go bust. We're not able to get all the good people are leaving, and we're left with the dredge of the earth. This is my concern with what Trump has done. I mean, he got over 20,000 people left, all right? Very nice. You make this offer to everybody. The people that are qualified, who actually can get a job real fast, are taking that money and leaving. All right? You're going to get stuck with what I observed. And I told this story to one of the board members of the IMF. Response was, yes, you're correct. We saw the same thing in Greece. All right. So that's my concern, that the good people are going to take the money and leave, and you're going to be left with the idiots who basically couldn't get a job, you know, brushing a floor, really. That's the downside of making such an offer to everybody. To be fair and equal.
Right.
You know,
what's going to happen then is like, okay, we made the offer. I mean, all the good people have taken the money and leaving. So that leaves us with the people that can't do the work. What's going to happen then? How does this play?
I'm not optimistic that how efficient the government is going to be afterwards. I don't think, you know, Trump before would just say, you're fired because you haven't done the job. But being, oh, I have to be fair and equitable, he's not used to this. And I don't think he's ever experienced what I did by making such a blanket offer. That's kind of, I think he's going to be shocked to see how this is working.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting for sure. Let's pivot back, or I should pivot to the Fed and that works with money flow and the idea of money flow. So the Fed, where exactly are they at and what choices do they make as policy? Because it seems like if they raise rates, it's going to kill the economy. And if they lower rates, it's going to kill inflation. It'll be inflation and kill the bond market. Correct me if I'm wrong. So what do they do?
Well, actually what's happened is when the Federal Reserve was first created, it was done absolutely brilliantly.
Jekyll Island, right?
That's all nonsense, really.
Well, nonsense.
That's somebody who I don't think really understood the design or anything else. When the Fed was actually created, we had 13 branches. All right. But why? Because there are regional capital flow problems. 1906, San Francisco earthquake, but all the insurance companies are on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. So the money flows from the East Coast to the West Coast. You end up with shortages in the East, and then you have banks failing. Okay. Nice. So that's why you have branches. If you can Google like newspapers.com or something, and just look at a newspaper from like 1927, you'll see a list. Each branch had a different interest rate. If there was a shortage in your area, you raise your rate to 4%, everybody else is 3% to attract money to your area,
right,
to balance it out. Okay. That was the design. Secondly, why it was so brilliant was that to stimulate the economy, they bought corporate paper, not government. That's what meant the lender of last resort. A corporation, the banks are kind of in trouble. They can't lend money to the local corporation. They have to start laying off people. So they could issue 90-day paper. The Fed would buy it. All right. They didn't have to lay off the people. That was the design. How did it get screwed up? World War I. Politicians come in. Oh, look, we're going to have to sell a lot more debt now to pay for the war. And instructs the Fed to buy the government debt, not corporate. Do they ever put it back? Never. All right. Then you have FDR come in. Great Depression. He wants to put in his New Deal. What does he do? He usurps all the branch power away and puts it in Washington and sticks in his guy. One interest rate fits all. All right. So these are just two examples of how the Federal Reserve has been screwed up. All right. Then there was a major rebellion by the Fed against Washington in 1951, right? During World War II, the White House instructed the Fed, be patriotic. We don't want interest rates to go up again during war. You put a cap on interest rates and the Fed buys in all government debt if it goes above that level. All right. They did that for World War II. Then the Korean War starts. Washington again says, we want you to do it again for the Korean War. The Fed said, enough is enough. We're not doing this. This is not good for the economy. The Fed actually rebelled and refused to accept it. So that was the big split. And it was in 1951. And then the Fed started saying, we're independent and we should be independent. We shouldn't be taking these orders back and forth to do whatever political agenda you might have. Now, the problem we're at today is, and why we end up talking to all these central banks is because they understand we know the profit. When Keynes came up with his idea in the 1930s, all right, the U.S. government had a balanced budget. So it made sense. We're going to raise interest rates or lower interest rates to affect demand, you and me, not the government. All right. Then World War II comes and all this debt comes, et cetera. All right. So today, because you changed it from corporate, which does have to pay off its debt, to government, which never does, the Fed is trapped. And all central banks are trapped. Mainly because if they raise interest rates, as Powell did to try and fight inflation, what happens? The interest expenditures of the government explode.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Nobody in government, and I don't care what government you're talking about, is going to say, oh, gee, the central bank is raising interest rates. They want us to spend less. Never going to happen. They don't know how to run for office anymore with socialism. And they always have to promise, you know, I'll give you this if you vote for me. I'll steal it from that guy and give it to you. You know, basically, that's what this is all about. So we don't have politicians that know how to run a government efficiently anymore. That's gone. So we have to be careful with all this stuff. And the Fed is, as well as other central banks, they're trapped. You know, this whole idea of Keynesian economics has failed. You can look on our site and Google it, Rediscovery of the Business Cycle. Paul Volcker did a book in 1978 after 1974, crash took place, OPEC and everything else. And he said, Rediscovery of the Business Cycle, Keynesian economics failed. He knew that back then.
Yeah.
Arthur Burns, you can also Google him on our site and look at his quote. He was the chairman, Fed chairman, when Bretton Woods collapsed. He came out and said, the business cycle always works.
Right.
So this is much of the problem that I can tell you. Everybody knows I was called in for, they were creating the G5 back in 1985. And they said, it's just a dog and pony show. They say, oh, we relied on 35 experts of the world, blah, blah, blah. All right. No, they don't. They call us all in and to pretend they're listening to you. And then they stand up and they say whatever they're going to do anyhow. So I wrote to Reagan at the time and said, look, you lower the dollar by 40%, you're going to cause a crash within a couple of years, which ended up being the 87 crash. And these people don't understand. I'm going to write a letter to Trump because we're hearing the same nonsense. Oh, if we lower the value of the dollar, we'll be able to sell more widgets and reduce the trade deficit. Very nice, but you're lowering the value of all assets in the United States as well. Okay. Back then, it was the Japanese had bought about a third of the national debt. And now you say you're going to devalue it by 40%? I said they're going to sell. Oh, well, because you're going to lose money, you idiot. All right. So when the 87 crash came, what caused it was the dollar had gone down after the Plaza Accord. All right. In 1980, in September 1985. Then by February 1987, the dollar had gone down precipitously. So they held another conference. It's called the Louvre Accord. I think it was February 1987 or something. And they then came out and said, all right, the dollar is going down, you know, enough. What happened? The dollar made a new low. That confirmed to everybody in the marketplace, the central banks can't control the value of the dollar.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So then that's what really sparked the 87 crash. It's just, you know, I can tell you they were calling up fund managers. Why did you sell? Because I called the floor. The Dow's down 1,000 points. Why? And they said, I have no idea. Because it was all foreign exchange. It wasn't like some economic number or something, or the Fed raising interest rates or lowering interest rates. There was nothing like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what's, you know, the fund manager's basically response was, I sold because I had no idea why it went down. It might do the same thing again tomorrow. If you don't understand what's happening, you get out. All right. So it's important to grasp this because it's a matter of confidence. And that's what I mean about central banks. That was the big mistake with the Louvre Accord. All right. Once you stand up and you say, this is it, this is my line in the sand, and it's not going to go here, and it does, you now only not look like a fool, but you look like you have no power to actually prevent it.
Right.
So it's a confidence game. And, you know, that's basically what it's always has been. So, you know, a crash will come out and you see Herbert Hoover, everything's fundamentally sound, blah, 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 you know, whatever. Yeah, it may be, but, you know, it's, we're all connected here. And, you know, I suggest reading, you know, Herbert Hoover's memoirs. They're free. It's online. Read the chapter 1931. Because all of Europe defaulted on its debt, which is going to happen again. And he's basically said at that, in there, he said, capital acted like a loose cannon on the deck of a ship in the middle of like a hurricane. We're shooting off in every which direction so fast we couldn't form a committee quick enough to even figure out where it was going. All right. The same thing happened in 2010 when Greece got into trouble. All right. All of a sudden, what did the traders do? Oh, made a lot of money on Greece. Who's next? Oh, Spain. Let's go over there, you know. And that's the way capital functions. Nobody's been in these trading rooms or whatever. They don't realize everybody's talking. Okay, fine. We got away with it on this one. What's next? You know, that's the way it is. You know, Japan peaked in 1989. Okay, what's next? Oh, Southeast Asia went down there. That blows up in 94. I mean, this is the way it is. I mean, they were all in there on Russia in 1998. You know, the Russian, you know, bond defaults ends up being a long-term capital management crisis. They're all in these things together. It's not, you know, George Soros, oh, the British, he's the one that got the notoriety for the pound, but they were all there. Yeah. It wasn't just him.
So what you just said is fascinating. And how does this relate to the BRICS? Is the BRICS, as you would call it, dog and pony show here, is that dead on arrival, DOA? I mean, it's just all talk, and that's just not going to happen as far as a similar currency with them, because we're all in this together, if that makes sense.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's largely people don't understand why the dollar is a reserve currency to begin with. All right. It's got nothing to do with gold or anything else, or even the government per se. It's the fact that the U.S. has the largest economy, but it's a consumer-based economy. So Germany needed to sell its BMWs and Mercedes to Americans. Japan sold its Toyotas, all right? So because they basically rebuilt the world on trade, you know, and So the dollar, they still have to sell their stuff here in dollars. So the dollar still has to be, you know, you can't say, okay, fine, I'm going to go buy a new Chevrolet. Well, the price in bricks is, you know, what? What's that? You know, it's always going to be dollars. And that's the way it is in every country. All right. Bricks is more, look, we've heard this nonsense that's going to place the dollar from the euro. You know, no, sorry. Why? I mean, when they were creating the euro, they came to me. So I had a front row seat to this whole thing. And I told them, I said, okay, fine, this is the way you create a currency. And they were saying they're going to, we'll all pay one interest rate like the United States. I said, not going to happen. All right. You have to consolidate the debt. You have to have a national debt for Europe. I'm a fund manager. Okay. I pick up the phone, buy me $10 billion worth of treasuries. No problem. I go to Europe. I still got to make the same decision. Do I want German bonds? Do I want it Italian? Do I want, you know, French or Spanish? I said, all you're going to do is move the volatility from the currency to the bond markets, which is what's happened. All right. I can tell you why they didn't do it as well. Because Helmut Kohl was the Chancellor of Germany at the time. And he basically even said before he died, he said he acted like a dictator. And he said the German people were never allowed to vote to join the euro, because he said he would have lost 7-3. So he took the country into the euro on an executive order. And his criteria was no consolidation of the debt, because then the Germans are going to think he's just bailing out Greece. So that's what this was about. And I warned them, this is not going to work. You're never going to compete with the dollar. All right. And they told me, I swear to God, what I heard back in 1998, look, we just got to get the euro through because they're trying to create this Brussels government. We'll worry about the debt later. Then here we are, 25, that's still separate, whatever, nothing's changed. In fact, all the people I probably spoke to back then are probably gone by now. This is it. I mean, they never really are concerned about what's actually structurally correct. They did the euro simply because we got to create this government. We want this power. That's it. And look at basically, Europe is not even a republic. Honestly, the head of the government, Ursula, is appointed by the other heads of state. She doesn't stand for election. None of the people on the European Commission who make the laws, nobody stands for election. And they basically do not believe in democracy. They take the Greek view that the people are too stupid to vote anyhow, so just shut up and do what we tell you. It's really a dictatorship.
Yeah.
They have no right to vote to say, well, I don't like the way this is going. You know, climate change, whatever. I can't vote on that. You have no say whatsoever.
Yeah. You brought up debt several times, and you said that's going to happen again. And I remember I was trading and just started my trading career in the 90s. I remember the Russian crisis. I remember the sell-off, and then I remember the Greek crisis in 2010. You said this is going to happen again. Where do you think it's going to start? And this is somewhat of a rhetorical question that you probably can't answer. And where do you think it's going to start? And when do you think it's going to hit the fan?
I think probably, maybe it will start in Europe or Japan. It's kind of a coin toss up. It looks to be more like around 27. And you can see it's starting already. If you look at France, all right, the government collapsed, et cetera. French corporate rates went below that of government. And the government rates of France went above that of Greece. That's showing you what I've been talking about. It's a shift from public to private. We have one of the biggest pension funds in North America. They basically started dumping government debt and moving to corporate. S&P walked in and to do an audit and said, oh, you're taking on more risk. And they said, look, sorry, we use Armstrong and we verified what he said. He's absolutely correct. The people that default are government and we get nothing. All right. If corporate defaults, they go into a bankruptcy, you get something back.
You get the assets, right?
You know, they sell off the assets, whatever. Probably the most famous one was the bank that started the panic in the Great Depression had the unfortunate name of the Bank of the United States in New York. It was a small bank. Somebody started a rumor and then there was a run on the bank and the bank, you know, closed, went into bankruptcy, but the name made people think it was the central bank. And that started the real banking crisis. There was 9,000 banks then failed, you know. But the bank went into bankruptcy. And when everybody was paid, they all got their money back. The assets were sold. And then, you know, it's a liquidity crisis more than anything.
Right.
A bank is taking your short-term money and lending it out long-term, mortgages or whatever. You run into the bank, hey, I want my money back right now. Well, they can't give it to you because it's invested long term. All right. So the banking rule, generally, they keep about 8% in cash to handle that. It goes beyond that. That's when they get in trouble. And that's when J.P. Morgan in the panic of 1907 is what inspired the Fed. He got the rest of the bankers together and said, look, if we don't bail out the bank that's in trouble, they're all going to come to us as well. And he sold that idea. He saved the bank and prevented a major banking crisis. So the Federal Reserve was designed on that. All right. And that's why the banks became the owner of the Fed, because they were supposed to chip in the money to bail out themselves, not taxpayer money. So I mean, that's why I say this, you know, Jekyll Hyde stuff is kind of like really not properly understood.
Well, and we'll end on this. Gold's been ripping for a while. What's gold's role on all of this? If you would, the dollar's not going to go away yet. And also, we're going to have a debt crisis that would be highly deflationary. But yeah, gold's ripping. And BRICS are a dog and pony show.
Oh, because eventually, look, what made the BRICS was simply Biden's stupid sanctions on Russia. Obama tried it in 2014 when they went into Crimea. Went to SWIFT, wanted to have them removed. And SWIFT refused, said, you're not going to turn this into a political weapon, which is correct. All right. It started this idea of removing people from SWIFT with Christine Lagarde when she was at the IMF. She was going around threatening these tax havens. If you don't give us everybody that's there, we're going to remove you from SWIFT and you can't get any money. She even did that to the Vatican. So that's where the idea came from. Once they imposed those sanctions on Russia, brain dead, absolutely stupid, because it sent a red flag to everybody else. Then you had the neocon Blinken threatening China. Oh, if you help Russia, we'll do this to you. You idiot. You have no clue how the world economy works. China had 10% of the U.S. national debt. They just started dumping, $53 billion the first quarter. You know, it was, long-term interest rate depend upon selling long-term debt. You know, we're in a Ponzi scheme. They sell the new debt to pay off the old, because they never pay off anything anyhow. All right. So the crash comes when you can no longer sell the new debt to buy the old, to pay off the old. So what happens is you end up, it's a back to that confidence crisis. You have Europe threatening war with Russia, blah, blah, blah. Macron saying, I'm going to send in troops. Go ahead. Don't you understand what's already happened? Your corporate rates are below that of government. You go to war, government debt's going to be pouring out, and who the hell is going to buy it? Now it depends upon if you win the war. Are you going to win the war? You lose the war, it can be like a Confederate bond. They make very nice, you frame them up and you stick them on your wall, you know? They don't understand these things. It's mind boggling, but that's why they used to send me in to explain the world economy to these people that, you know, they're just counting coupons at the local, food store. That's about it. And you're lucky if they can add it up without a pocket calculator. But it's, so I see the more you move towards war, and the risk here is with the debt in Europe. Europe has been committing an economic suicide. Take Germany. You put in all this climate change nonsense. Japan had the nuclear energy debacle. Merkel says, oh, no nuclear energy. Kill off coal. Make these windmills. Very nice. All right. Germany was the cornerstone of the EU economy. All right. It has shrunk by 3%. You put people out of business. They can't afford to make things at these high levels. Then you put the sanctions on Russia. It's kind of like shooting yourself in the foot and saying, see, I'm going to do this to you unless you do what I tell you. it's idiotic. We blew up Nord Stream 1. Nord Stream 2 is there. And Germany has just voluntarily not turned it on. So their entire industrial complex is crumbling. Then you have this climate change nonsense, which Brussels is starting to realize that maybe they went too far. It gets to be, impossible. I mean, I had to run over to Europe for some meetings. I was in Berlin. I had to run down to Rome. I couldn't even get a direct flight. I had to hire my own private jet to take me down there. Because all this short, climate change, we don't want to have all these, connecting flights like that. So they reduce them. I'm like, I can't get a flight. So I had to hire a small private jet to get me down to another meeting with the Italian government. I mean, it's crazy. Just completely crazy.
Where is the role of gold in that, though? I mean, again, do you still see that as having place, or is that the reason to the rise because of all of the crazy nonsense that's going on?
Gold's role has really nothing to do with inflation. That's just all propaganda from years. Gold rises on geopolitical.
Okay.
Yeah, if you just look at, you know, it, gold fell to $100 in 1976. During the stagflation period of OPEC, et cetera. And it finally rose to 400 by December 79. But it went from 400 to 875 in the last 6 weeks. Why? That's when Russia invaded Afghanistan. All right. Gold's role is being neutral. You don't have to worry about which government wins the war. You know, and it's the same commodity globally, as opposed to, I mean, there's even a difference between Brent crude and Texas crude. I mean, but gold is the same everywhere. So that's to its advantage. Now, its disadvantage is coming. I know some of the gold producers, the government is also aware of that, and they're making the refiners say where every gram comes from and where it's going. They will probably include it in capital controls. I can tell you what Italy does already. If you have a lot of gold jewelry on, they make you take it off and weigh it.
That's crazy.
This is the way it is. It's like, you know, governments are never for you. They're always for themselves. And they see it as money moving, you know. And the problem is, fine, 50 years ago, you could put a bunch of gold coins, stick it in your briefcase, hop on a plane and go someplace. No problem. I doubt you can do that today. There was a guy down here in Tampa that had $100,000 in cash to go buy a tractor. And it wasn't even him. It was an employee of a company. They sold the cash. They confiscated it. And then they had to go to court to prove that it was legitimate cash. He's just paying cash for a tractor. The guy wanted cash, not a certified check. And then they call it civil asset forfeiture. So, you know, it's questionable whether you could really even take a roll of $20 gold pieces, you know, with you someplace. It's, but this is what we have to expect when we do go into war. And I've been warning Europeans, when that first shot is fired, out comes the capital controls. You won't be able to move money out of there. Just look at what they did in World War I. They shut down all the stock markets. Why? Because you could sell stock here, buy stock here, and sell it over in New York. Get the money out. Bitcoin. Why did Bitcoin take off? Very simple. If you, you know, pick up the rug and look, you know, all the volume was coming out of China. Why? Because the Chinese figured if I could buy it here, then I could sell it in the U.S. and get my money out. Then and the Bank of China called all the Bitcoin people in and said, hey, wait a minute now. You know, Bitcoin's risen mainly because you're starting to see Europeans use it the same way for money laundering. In that sense, it is like gold, that it's the same thing in different jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, wheat or something like that. You know, it's a bit different. But look, we live in interesting times. And all you have to do is just look at what responses governments have done before in time of war, because they will always respond the same way. They put in price wage controls. Look, you can even Google that. When the first real recorded price and wage controls of the Roman Emperor Diocletian in 285 AD. You know, so not much has changed. I mean, you can go to the island of Delos in Greece. The Temple of Apollo was like their central bank back then. And there's a stele there listing all the city-states that defaulted on their debt. And that was 400 BC. So
correct.
Spain defaulted on its debt 7 times, became a serial defaulter. They successfully took themselves from the richest country of Europe to basically pauper status. I mean, so all these things, you know, they will always act in their own self-interest. And they don't look at the long term. It's, I just have to survive the next election.
Got it. Well, I think we'll end on that. Martin Armstrong, Marty, I am a huge fan. I love listening to you, all of your interviews. You need no introduction, but I'll give it to you anyways. Where can people find you online if they want to read more about you?
Armstrongeconomics.com. You don't have to put your email in or anything. We try and keep it as an open forum for the world. We do have offices around the world, and it's interesting because I didn't think about it before, but a political friend of mine said, "Do you realize you're the only one that's not blocked worldwide?" And I didn't think about it. I said, you're right. They look at us in Russia, China, and everywhere. So it's interesting because they know it's more the computer forecast. It's not, oh, by the way, on page 3, you know, overthrow your government's shit or whatever, you know. Just try to keep it, you know, straightforward economics. We base it on history. So it's not a personal opinion per se.
Well, I will put all of this in the YouTube channel, the website, as well as the Apple and Spotify podcast. Marty, I want to thank you so much for your time. It was one of the most stimulating conversations I've had in a while.
Well, thank you. Nice seeing you. And hopefully we get people to understand how the world really functions.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.